All right, everybody, it is time for another episode of the Crypto 101 podcast. But before we dive in to our awesome, awesome guest and conversation today, I want to remind you guys of two things. And the first one is that if you go to crypto101insider.com, you can join our private community. Here's where we have our model portfolio and all of our top picks. We also have Crypto 101 University, where we have hours and hours and hours of written and video content that explains blockchain and explains cryptocurrency in a very bite-sized and easy to understand way. And we have a weekly newsletter that goes out and quarterly state of crypto addresses that go out. There is just a ton of value packed into this every which way. So I want you guys first to go to crypto101insider.com today, if you haven't already. I also want to remind you guys that Pizza Mind and I recently just finished a book. It took 11 months of our lives to write, and we're calling it Crypto Revolution, Your Guide to the Future of Money. We walk you through this fascinating world of cryptocurrencies and blockchain, and it's part history book, it's part instructional guide, and it's going to really show you guys why cryptocurrencies are globally disruptive and how they're going to actually change in real life and in real terms the way that we buy and sell and even live. We include a bunch of how-tos on getting started with your first exchanges. We give you tips on how to safely buy and sell and store cryptocurrencies, as well as how do we evaluate potentially good cryptocurrencies. And the best part of the book is that we're giving it away for free. All you have to do is pay for shipping and handling. So go to cryptorevolution.com and pick up your copy today. All right, everybody, welcome back to another action-packed episode here at the Crypto 101 podcast. It's your host, Bryce Paul, joined by my notorious companion, the PIZ, Mr. Pizza Mind. How you doing, buddy?
You know, it's been actually a few months since we've sat down and recorded a podcast. We had such an amazing backlog of episodes, but I still feel like I need a vacation, Bryce. It's been a ridiculously busy last few months for us. We've done so much. We've got our hands in so many different things. And I feel like I just need a change of scenery. I just recently moved to Texas and it's really, really nice over here, but it's much different than the beach. But I love diversifying my locations and the different, you know, things that I can do in my life. But I feel like I need an oasis as my next destination, Bryce. Can you potentially find one? Is there anything you can recommend?
You know, you are really right on track. You found your personal oasis in Texas, part of the exodus away from California. I found my DeFi oasis in Luca Cosentino, who runs the DeFi department and all things brainchild over at Oasis Labs. Luca, thank you for joining us on the podcast today.
Yes, big pleasure to be here. Great connecting with you. Great meeting you all.
Yeah, we're going to have a really, really fun conversation. You know, I'm excited about all the things. You know, I've been keeping tabs on you guys for a while, and you guys launched Mainnet maybe, 3 months ago or so. You guys are a layer one blockchain, which for a lot of the new folks that are out there listening, maybe this is the first time you've heard a podcast on crypto. Welcome. You're like, what the hell is layer one? We're going to get into all that stuff. Don't worry about it. This is Crypto 101. We keep things at a high level. And we bring you guys really the most cutting edge projects and companies that are shaping the landscape in the future of finance. But before we dive into that stuff, Luca, let's get acquainted. Who are you? You know, in a sense, what were you doing before you stumbled upon cryptocurrency? And, you know, how did you arrive at Oasis Labs?
Yeah, great question. So in my previous life, I was always working in product or product additions roles at big corporates. I worked for Procter & Gamble, American Express, Google. And I moved to California from Italy via the UK to get my MBA at UC Berkeley. And while I was at Berkeley, I had the big pleasure of spending some time dealing with crypto and getting more and more familiar with the technology side of blockchain and crypto. But that passion and interest in crypto started way before, around 2013, when I was an intern and I was like curious about different ways of paying and different technologies that were actually being created all over the world. Then I came across this weird thing called Bitcoin. It's like doubling in price over time. And back in time, when we say doubling, we were actually at $200, $300, something like that. And I started playing a little bit with this and I said, okay, maybe there's something cool in those. And I went to my VPs, who were people who had like, what, 20, 30 years of experience in payments. And I asked them, like, do you think it makes sense that I spend a little bit of time like researching what this is? And they told me like, not really, it's not in scope. We don't know what that is. We don't want to deal with that. Like it's a video game, et cetera. And frankly, I made a huge mistake of trusting them because I thought, wait, those are people who know what they're doing. They're leading a primary company in the credit card space. They must know what they're doing. And so I kind of abandoned that, even though I remained a little bit involved on the more like trading side of the things, but like we're talking about little experiments here. So years later, it was very cool to see that that thing became a thing and became something that had much more potential. So I decided to, as I said before, like to invest a little bit more resources into understanding what was going on. And having worked in product and data related roles before, I had this idea to use blockchain to somehow create some ways to help companies deal with data in a more programmatic way while keeping the data more secure. So my high level goal was there must be a way for these larger organizations to get more and more value from the data that they deal with without giving up the like security and cryptography and protection of this data. I admittedly Googled who the privacy experts were in my network. And I stumbled upon this UC Berkeley professor, Dawn Song. And at that point, it turned out that she was working on something extremely similar. She was approaching this from the technology standpoint, and I was leading with the use case. And so the partnership somehow felt very natural. So I joined what then became her company, like just like a few weeks later. And I've been the first employee outside of the software engineers, of course, in the team. And since then, I've been working on the main launch of the main network. I've been leading the DeFi efforts of our company, and DeFi stands for decentralized finance, for those who don't know that, and we can talk about it in depth. But I've been there since its inception, and it's been like crazy and incredibly interesting to create this decentralized network from scratch.
Yeah, I love just kind of how you started that with, you know, you're working at payments, and then you think the guys that are running the companies know what's on the fringe, and they just completely missed it. I think that's a story that so many people have, that, you know, it just goes to show that sometimes the people in charge don't really know what the hell is going on. And in fact, you know, I had a conversation the other week with a guy from JP Morgan who reached out to me, and he said, hey, you know, I love the podcast. I work on the like financial advisory side of JP Morgan. We are so far from like being able to, you know, recommend cryptocurrencies in clients' portfolio. It's still maybe a year and a half, 2 years out, but we're trying to get a lay of the land. I'm thinking like, oh my God, you guys are 2 years away. You know, JP Morgan, right? You should know everything about, you know, what's on the fringe and how to deploy capital effectively and generate returns for your clients. Like, that's literally your fiduciary obligation. And you're telling me clients don't even have the modus operandi to get into the market. And I was speaking to another guy at Merrill Edge. Literally, I went golfing with him 2 days ago, And he was like talking to me about like his financial advisory business that he's doing at Merrill Edge. And he's like, we can't even recommend Grayscale products to anybody. We can't even recommend pot stocks. And so it's just like these companies that you think and you believe in and that are on the, you know, oh, they got this big building. It's JP Morgan. It's Merrill. It's Bank of America. These are the guys that I trust. Like, they don't know upside from down, man. It's just nuts. Sorry, that was a rant.
I think it depends on a combination of elements. We won't go into like details here, but I think it's a combination of elements that range from incentives to risk and to explore paths that are not mentioned specifically within their within the boundaries of the OKRs or like the goals of people in charge. But I also think it's a it's generally impossible for very focused people to keep track of the so many innovations that happen over your career that you necessarily end up ignoring some of them. Sometimes you're right and you ignore what doesn't become big, but sometimes you're wrong and you ignore something that becomes like bigger than what you think before you even figure out. And I think this goes back to the old story that explains how startups compete with giants, which is if a startup figures the distribution before the giant notices that problem, the startup ends up becoming something. Now, there's no startup in this case because there are decentralized networks, but I think the story still applies.
I would just think if I had, a $1 trillion corporation, I would hire a bunch of entrepreneurs, straight out of college just to work for me and starting up things and researching this stuff. You know, I could afford a staff of 10 people to make sure that my business didn't go to zero, but maybe that's just me. I don't know.
I mean, that's how I got my start. Yeah, that's how I got my start. I was working in the kind of the traditional media side of the world. I studied film and media, and my boss one day came up to me and was like, "Hey, like, have you heard of blockchain and all these different ways that blockchain could kind of reinvent the advertising business and just media in general, media distribution networks?" And I was like, "Oh, blockchain. That sounds interesting." Never really dove into it. And, this was five years ago now. But it's just funny how, he was doing that. He was trying to say, well, where are the different kind of attack vectors from a CEO of a media company and all the different, technology that's on the fringe? But very cool stuff. So Luca, let's dive into kind of the mission of Oasis. You guys are dead focused on preserving privacy, which is hyper relevant right now, kind of in the light of everything that's going on in the world. So tell us a little bit about your mission and what Oasis Labs is really trying to accomplish.
Yeah, for sure. So Oasis is laser focused on becoming this privacy enabled blockchain platform for open finance and responsible data economy. And I think this is very interesting because at first, it seems that all these elements are maybe not that related. Like there are people working on finance, there are people working on data, and there are people working on privacy, there are people working on blockchain, and then some intersections. But I think I think Oasis did a great job in spending a lot of cycles thinking, what is the connection between all these elements? And I think this is not evident. Because the second order consequences of having privacy of a network are much bigger than what the term privacy suggests. And let me explain what I mean here. When we think of privacy, we often think of, like you need to protect your data, you need to make sure that someone doesn't see your information and stuff like that. But I think there's much more than this. And I think this observation started from one interesting point, which is there is this like history of privacy that suggests that people don't really care about privacy if that blocks convenience or if that blocks access to a certain new product. And you have this thing happening over and over, right? Starting from thousands of years ago when people were doing like private things that are now private, they were doing that in public because they didn't have like walls in their houses. And once someone built those walls, people went to do these things inside instead of outside. And then like flash forward to 1,000 years later, when maybe like the first telephone was invented, you had people going into a room and speaking out loud in front of everyone else and just to be able to use that telephone. And then like the subsequent innovation was someone creating the headphones as a way not to reveal your conversation to the same participants of that room, and that found immediate adoption, because effectively when people need to trade like convenience for privacy, they take convenience. But when you offer privacy, that becomes an incentive to do the same thing in a more private way, people generally do that. Like historically, more than generally do that. Now, so what does this? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I was just going to talk like, how do you incentivize people to be private? Is that through paying them to be private, essentially?
Yeah. So this is where I was heading too. So what happens is that too often privacy in every market or in every product you can think of is always like presented as a trade-off, right? As something that you need to accept or block or do something. And there's not really an incentive for you to do that, right? Like you want to block cookies, you have a worse experience. You want to delete your account from Facebook, you're not going to be part of your social network. You want to like protect your credit cards, you don't shop online. And the list of examples is basically endless. So what is the key point that I think we realized? The key point that we realized is that privacy should be an incentive and not a trade-off. And if you start thinking that way, the idea of privacy completely switches to another dimension, right? Now, let me be a little bit more concrete. Let's take the blockchain example, which is what we're talking about here. You have these networks that are completely transparent. And transparency is a great feature for some use cases or some specific reasons, but it becomes a problem when you need to protect some of the interesting things that some maybe like users or companies or participants in general need to do. Because effectively, privacy can mean some things that are extremely interesting for the users or participants. Again, first of all, you want to protect your commercial interests, even if you don't want to hide specifically, because just for the sake of hiding, you need to hide or you need to keep some information private for that information to be valuable. Otherwise, it's not valuable anymore. You need to be able to put the sensitive information in some place that is isolated and protected from the public or from everyone to maybe compete or to maybe like hold your competitive advantage. And this opens up to a massive problem that exists in traditional businesses and in blockchain when there's full transparency. And this is problem that I'm referring to is the collaboration between users and enterprises, for instance, right? This is one example. So you have these enterprises that could be seen as platforms that at the very beginning, when they are young, they have a big incentive in cooperating with their users. So their policies are very well explained. Their condition and terms are very well written. You open a website of a startup, it's generally 10 times clearer than a website of an enterprise. But even when you consider platforms such as like developer platforms, et cetera, the rules and terms are always very clear. And because they need to cooperate with their users in order to attract more and more users. And the same applies to really like every consumer app, every service, every enterprise application. It's always the same story. But once the enterprise passes a certain threshold or passes this critical mass, their behavior starts changing, because the relevance of that one user becomes lower and lower and lower and lower over time, right? One user is very important when you have 5 users, but it's much less relevant when you have a billion users on your platform, right? So what does this mean? This means that the enterprise itself has this incentive to reduce the level of collaboration with the users and exploits the users as much as possible, right? So they implement strategy to collect more data than they need, more information than they need. And so the consumer keeps losing like relative value, relative importance to the company, or relevant like bargaining power. While one of the things that we realized at Oasis is that a lot of this competition or a lot of this tension happens around the data, right? The company tries to get as much information as possible from the user and gets ownership and transfer of that data every time, because there is no way for the user to retain that information and decide who they want to share that information with and at which cost and at which price. Now, blockchain plus privacy solve that. Users can retain their own information. This information goes inside a capsule, which is managed by the user, and the user decides who they want to share the information with and why. So this opens up the market to like people who want to maybe sell or maybe give away or maybe like whatever term you want to use there. And we can deep dive a little bit more into potential models, but it creates a space for a programmatic collaboration between users and companies that may be incentivized by money, which is one option, or it may be incentivized by supporting a certain cost, which is a second option, or it may be incentivized by other things that we haven't explored yet. But that's where the responsible data economy starts. All of a sudden, the data becomes a factor of production that users should be compensated for in some form, and they can put to work because someone else will extract some value from this data and build products or services from this data.
Speaking of that, building products and services, there are a lot of 100% legal industries here in the United States that struggle to get banking, that struggle to get merchant accounts to be able to take credit cards, that struggle to get insurance, all because the nature of their business, while legal, may be frowned upon by whomever. So that applies to adult bookstores, that applies to gun shops, that applies to cannabis, and that also applies to crypto. You know, none of us are bad guys. I shouldn't say none of us, but none of us here on this call, at least anyway. But still, if I, you know, go into a bank right now and say, hey, I've got, you know, six figures worth of money, but it's in crypto, it's now legal for your bank to, you know, accept Bitcoin or stable coins, can I open an account? They would laugh me out of the building. And this is a problem that many of these other merchants face. They have to take cash, but we're moving to a cashless society. And with these new rules being proposed by FinCEN that would force people to identify their Bitcoin and Ethereum wallets, even if they were accepting crypto at these locations, now suddenly the bank could say, oh, you're trying to, you know, deposit through here, through this exchange, you know, no, I'm going to ban your accounts again. So with these regulations, they're trying to circumvent the very reason crypto was invented, and that's financial inclusion. That is the reason that crypto is here. It's not supposed to be more convenient. It's supposed to be inclusive and available for everyone. So with what you're building at Ocean, it's very, very important. And when we talk about a layer one solution, that means you're not dependent on any other company or technology to work. If something else breaks elsewhere in the world, Oasis is still going. Is that correct?
Yeah. So what you said, I think, there is one part of what you said that is really relevant to the way Oasis sees the evolution of this new financial system that is supposed to happen in parallel to the actual one, but maybe one day we'll replace it. And it's this idea that it should be inclusive, right? Now, at Oasis, like we clearly are not experts of any like regulation or compliance matters, because we do technology, right? That's what the company does best. But I think the idea here is enabling a certain vision, and this vision for the decentralized finance that we see in the future is really this open, financial system that runs in parallel to a traditional system, but it's based on rules that are universally accessible or like respectable, and that everyone in the world, no matter what was the wealth, no matter what the geography, or no matter what is the status, can access and can participate into, as long as they have a smartphone and an internet connection and maybe something more than that. But while we think that one of the aspects that is missing in the current DeFi space, and again, DeFi stands for this decentralized finance system, is that decentralized finance should not be just the place where you can get higher interest rates, like by stacking different interest rates, but should be this place where, to some extent, it doesn't really matter what preconditions you have, as long as you respect the rules that that specific protocol has put in place for you.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. No. I think that was spot on, and kind of like when I look at the smart contract landscape right now, there's not many platforms that have privacy built into the layer one. So, you know, I guess, without getting too technical, what problems would you say are solved by having privacy at the smart at the base layer of the technology, as opposed to just being a wrapper on top of it?
Well, I think so. First of all, one thing I love to say is that there's a lot of privacy in the market, right? There's a lot of privacy coins, privacy smart contracts. There's a lot of stuff that is related to term privacy. But one aspect that may be confusing for listeners is like, is it all the same privacy or privacy associated to different pieces, maybe a different one?
And I think let's break that down.
Yeah, I think that's key for Oasis, because Oasis is not a privacy coin. It's not something that is meant to hide information from the masses. But the point of Oasis having smart contracts that keep the data private is that being able to execute some transaction or being able to execute some calculation doesn't also imply to reveal the information to the entire network. And the point is that developers can actually write smart contracts that keep the input of the smart contracts private and confidential, while not sacrificing the ability to make this data and information valuable. This is, I think, it's a key differentiating factor for Oasis. And we want to be very mindful of this, because it guides a lot of the actions that the network will take going forward. Now, when it comes to the problems that the presence of privacy solves, the way I organize my thoughts is generally thinking of the two types of problems that are solved. There are the, like, what I call the direct problem and the kind of indirect positive consequences that this brings. So when you think of a transparent network that is also decentralized, you can think of a situation where all the business interests are public, which means that the participation of a certain user or a certain company is actually public. And stuff like transactions can be spied. And once you can spy a transaction, what you can do is that you can also copy that transaction. And so the question becomes at this stage, like, okay, if there are two competing transactions, which transaction goes first?
This is a huge problem in DeFi, that all these transactions through the AMMs get front run, right? Like, right. I'll kind of verify that I want to make this transaction, and somebody comes in, front runs me, and puts in a higher gas price. So then that transaction gets processed and I get stuck on pending. I'm like, what the hell?
Exactly. So you got exactly where I was going. And that's one of my first, that's probably my first like indirect consequence of the lack of privacy somehow, which is, given what you just said, given that I can see the transaction, given that I can copy the transaction, and given that I can also offer a higher price for that transaction, I will do that, right? I will do that. And this means that there is a market for, all of a sudden, from the lack of privacy, now we switch the problem to the fact that there is a second market for gas fees, which means that the gas fees go up, and the average participants will have to pay more to participate in that network, which and you create this situation that is opposite to what blockchain is meant to do, which is like coordination of large ecosystems, because all of a sudden you are incentivizing a few people, which are these like self-motivated traders, but you are scaring away the majority of people who will not be able to make any convenience out of the fact that they need to pay $150 for submitting a certain transaction. So that's one, right? So so again, to sum up, you have these direct and indirect consequences. The direct one are the most easy to spot on, which are like the like business interests are public. You cannot protect commercial negotiations or maybe like participation or relationships, etc. But then there are the indirect ones that are, for instance, the fact that there is a market for fees that limits participation of the most people. It's kind of impossible to create a user reputation because there is no place where you can put the data that belongs to a certain user, given that everyone has the data of everyone, which creates an incentive for people to create multiple wallets, which are the kind of equivalent in the crypto space of an identity without all the attestation and documents and all the parts. And then the third one, which is again very similar to this one, is that the users don't really control their data, and they cannot put their data in places that then can be served to third party institutions or organizations that will use that information. And this last problem is connected to the problem to the previous problem, which is given the users don't control their data, it's basically impossible to create a reputation system that that puts all the action of a certain user in one place instead of separating bad and good actions on different wallets or identities. And so that's another indirect consequence of the lack of privacy that Oasis would love to solve. And that's why I talked before about the intersection of responsible data economy and open finance. Because when you start thinking of finance as a series of financial incentives, and you start thinking of data as something that motivates those financial incentives, you can start linking the two, and those two start overlap, at least for some percentage, that make it very interesting to cover both at the same time.
When we talk about DeFi, it's a general overview of a suite of products. It's not just one thing. There are lending and borrowing platforms like Maker and Compound. There's exchanges like Uniswap and Kyber Network. What angle of DeFi is being built at Oasis?
Yeah, great question. I'll give you an interesting answer here. So for the most part, being a layer one, Oasis has this vision of becoming one of the best platforms for development. And so the first thing that Oasis needs to keep in mind is that the target user is the developer first, and the developer wants a very smooth experience, wants its users to pay low fees, wants its users to be able to submit multiple transactions, again, respecting privacy if needed in this case. But they also want to be able to find the main services and the main protocols already integrated and available on that network. So they don't want to do the portability of a certain Oracle, for instance, or for a certain stablecoin, or for a certain, custodian, or for a certain, what else I can mention, like liquid staking provider, and so on and so forth. So one of the main goals of Oasis was to build this network and ecosystem of partners to create this very smooth experience for developers when they want to build applications on the Oasis network. So the Oasis network offers these developers the flexibility of writing public or private smart contracts, paying low fees at scale, and finding all these pre-integrated protocols and services on the network. So this is like the first part to answer your question. And we built a crazy rich ecosystem. There's plenty of documentation and ecosystem maps that our brilliant marketing team put together. And you're going to notice it takes a few seconds to notice this is one of the richest ecosystems in the space. Now, the second part of the answer I want to give you is that the DeFi will start from, so the DeFi space always start, I mean, every financial system starts from credit, or lending, right? Because that's always the primitive of the financial system, because it's the space where you can trade this excess of capital, and you can move it from who has too much to who needs something in exchange for an interest rate. And there is the part where the reputation and data are needed probably the most, right?
Yeah.
Like this is absolutely the place where you need to know who the user is, you need to trust the user, and you need to reward good behaviors. Mm-hmm. So the idea of the responsible data economy, the idea of these capsules that are owned by the users, the idea of creating a composable credit score that doesn't rely on a central agency, but allows any lender to, any lender, whether centralized or decentralized, better if decentralized, of course, to build customized credit scores that depend on their own needs. I think that's the ability that Oasis can provide the most value to. But still, the network provides very horizontal benefits to the entire DeFi space, because when you start solving the problem of high transaction fees, low scalability and privacy, those features are very horizontal across any type of use case that you can think of.
Yeah, it's one of those things that, you know, there's so many added benefits here. Now it's about getting the user adoption and the developer adoption. Because when I think about, you know, Ethereum, right? It's, you know, it blew up, right? It's now a bigger a bigger open source developer community than freaking Linux, bigger That's than Bitcoin. Right. I mean, there's more developers on Ethereum than there are on Bitcoin. And so there's this little shift. And so it's hard to, you know, attack something that's already had that market share. And I think it's fair to say that Oasis is absolutely a competitor to Ethereum. But is there ever a future in your mind where these coexist and these interoperate?
Yeah. So I actually think that the vision of all the layer ones being competitors is motivated by the fact that that each of them like has to compete for the similar place in the architecture. But at the same time, I think the distinction and the differentiators of each networks are going to create this space where these networks will absolutely interoperate and become more and more interoperable every quarter, because the ability of focusing on more than one or two things is extremely complicated, especially when you have to think about it doing those at scale while fostering your community, while innovating, while keeping up with the market, while building partnerships, while doing all these things. So
yeah,
the way I see it is kind of like there is a massive M&A that happens in the crypto space, not run by an investment firm, but run by all these communities that merge together around the specialties of each of these projects. So I totally see how in the short term, at least, these networks will become more and more interoperable, which means that assets will be able to flow more and more freely on these different networks. They will be able to take the properties of that specific network and then switch over to the next one for what the second network is very good at. And then they will all be connected by bridges. And those bridges will disappear with time and become more and more integrated, either inside the wallets or maybe like hidden from the user flow, or this like idea of wrapping tokens. will become more popular. So there are like different theories of how this will work. But I think that the common denominator is that tokens will move across different networks. Some layer one networks will be both layer one networks and layer 1.5/2 to each other. Someone will have liquidity, someone will have privacy, someone will have maybe like better developer tool, I don't know. And so the hope is that these networks will be working together to create a very complete infrastructure for people to focus on the layer above that, which is either the protocol or application layer, depending on which structure we're talking about.
Yeah, fascinating. And we haven't even gotten into really tokenized data. And that's something that I wanted to talk about briefly insofar as, you know, what is tokenized data and can people earn a yield for kind of tokenizing their data? And then, you know, that'll be the last question, then we'll wrap things up.
Yep, absolutely. So let me start from where I left before with this idea of identities and capsules, right? So the best way to see what the Oasis network offers is, again, like what I said before, and I know it's not a simple concept, so I'll try to like explain that one more time. So there is an identity, which is a user or a user inside an organization, and then there is a capsule. And the capsule is filled with data points that may come from different places. And those capsules are somehow independent from identities, but also the identities are the ones that can control these capsules with like read, write, share permissions. So now that we have created this relationship between identities and capsules, you can add one more feature on top, which is the ability of programmatically share or like take some actions on this data. And what this means is that you can say, okay, under these specific rules, maybe allow this person to look at my data or maybe just use that data within a computation model, which could be a machine learning model, but do not reveal the data itself, only allow the model to like run on that data. So this brings, again, like two properties, the programmability of this relationship that I just described, and the fact that the data stays private throughout the entire life cycle. It's not revealed, and so it's reusable at any point in time. So now you need to introduce this idea of data tokenization, right? Mm-hmm. Because for a certain protocol to be able to deal with an asset, that protocol needs to recognize that certain asset in an automatic way. Like even humans recognize a dollar for some properties. Your bank recognizes a digital dollar. A system that is proprietary of a certain company recognizes a type of information and classifies that information depending on how relevant it is for that specific company. What you need is a protocol, or you need something that does that with any type of data. And in order to do that, you need to do a more atomic way of atomic representation of a data set that is recognizable by the players that deal with that atomic representation of the data. And once you have that, which is this data token, now you can create a protocol that is very similar to a compound of DeFi. And this protocol takes in these data tokens and lends them out based on the actual demand that there's for that specific data token. So you can imagine this world where a lot of users control their data, and they all decide that they want to lend it. They want to lend this data within a certain protocol, and then a marketing company can come in, train their model on this data by borrowing this data automatically, and then once they're done, they break the contract automatically. And they transfer the corresponding amount of money, for instance, or rewards to the actual data borrower, data lender, sorry. So now you have created this relationship between data lenders and data borrowers that connect over this relationship of exchanging data. And again, when we say exchanging data, the key part is that the data is not actually transferred from one place to another one, but it's only accessed for a purpose of a certain computation. Mm. And so the same way the dollar is exchanged in and out in exchange for an interest rate that is either calculated by a central entity in the central world or dynamically calculated based on supply and demand. Now you can do the same exact thing with data, where depending on how many people or how many queries people want to do on my data becomes more valuable and vice versa, which solves the big problem of how should be data priced.
Yeah. So now, you know, guys, think of a future. Everybody who's listening, to just understand that there is a future out there where the data that you produce online, it is valuable currently, but it will be monetized through different protocols like this. Luca, ton of fun. I loved getting to know you, loved getting to know all about Oasis Labs. I just got one last question for you, and it's a question we ask everybody that comes on the show, and it's as simple as this. It's, you know, if this is the very first podcast that somebody in the crypto space was listening to, what would you want them to know, right? So day one in crypto land, we know how crazy it is. We know how fun it is. What would you want these day one folks to know?
I want them to know why blockchain, why DeFi, and why privacy. So why blockchain? I give an answer, which is to create coordination across participants of a certain network in a very automatic and programmatic and incentivized way. Why DeFi? And I'd say to create an open, transparent, and accessible financial system with that is probably an alternative to the current one. And then why privacy? I think that privacy will make a user control web a real thing from my vision.
Fascinating. All right, Luca, thank you so much for spending just about an hour with us today. If we want to find more about Oasis Labs, where do we go?
Yeah, sure. So all the Oasis network related things are continuously posted on our Twitter and Telegram. All the links are on the website oasisprotocol.org. And those are maybe the three best sources for that. We always release information there. There is a community that runs all these activities. There are governance proposals, and the network is really taking off and has really taken off in a very decentralized way, both from the technical and business standpoint.
Awesome. So Oasis Protocol, Oasis Network, and Oasis Labs are all part of a similar, they're all working on the Oasis Network. Is that right?
They all contribute to the Oasis Network. The Oasis Network is the base layer. And then Oasis Labs is a core contributor to the Oasis Network. Got and it. The Oasis Network and the Oasis Foundation are like decentralized entities that follow the protocol of the decentralized world.
Awesome. Wonderful. Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed today's episode of the Crypto 101 podcast. We will catch you same time, same place next week.